You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this week's episode, host Sally Warhaft speaks with Hong Kong pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong about the motivations of Hong Kong's youth-led political movement, how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting protests, and how protests are taking on new approaches.
Welcome, everybody, to the Fifth Estate. My name is Sally Warhaft, and our guest was born in 1996. He's one of the most influential young leaders in the world. In 2011, at aged 14, he founded a group called Scholarism in Hong Kong and successfully protested against the enforcement of Chinese national education. It catapulted him into international political stardom. By 2014, he was on the cover of Time magazine with the caption, "The Face of Protest." 2 years ago, he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his leadership in Hong Kong's umbrella movement. Today, he's the Secretary General of Demosista, a pro-democracy organisation he founded in 2016. He's the author of Unfree Speech, The Threat to Global Democracy and Why We Have to Act Now. Welcome, Joshua Wong.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
I want to begin by asking you how things are in Hong Kong, particularly, of course, in relation to the coronavirus.
With the outbreak of coronavirus, we're just aware how Beijing just try to take the advantage of to silence the voice of dissidents, no matter conduct mass arrests in the previous week or how to expanding its authoritarian ideology, not only in Hong Kong, Taiwan or China, but even in Europe, in Western country and etc. But I think how Hong Kongers still continue to fight for democracy, which is really remarkable.
What about what's actually going on in terms of lockdown and so on in Hong Kong at the moment? Obviously, it's been very successful compared to other parts of the world, as has Australia and Melbourne, where we're talking to you from. What are the restrictions at the moment that you're dealing with?
On 1st of January of this year, we mobilized more than 1 million people, took to the street to ask for free election. And Hong Kong is just a small city with 7 million population, so the ratio is extremely high. And since February, because of the outbreak of coronavirus, which is difficult for us to mobilize people or to join assembly, etc. But we still have kind of virtual protests, online assembly, live stream engagement, and etc. Hope to try to use several way and campaign to keep the momentum. But why the number of confirmed cases of the COVID-19 dropped to zero for more than 2 weeks already in Hong Kong is not because of the contribution of Hong Kong government. It's because of how we strengthen the civil society development. When Hong Kong is at the shortage of surgical masks, we try to import surgical masks since early February. And we also encourage youngsters, help more underprivileged people, elderly, cleaning workers, and etc. Help to clean their home and also care for their needs. So with our sensitivities to China, and we all really are aware that WHO is just manipulated by Beijing, and the Secretary General of World Health Organization is just one of the Beijing loyalists.
So you're saying that the success of stemming the outbreak of coronavirus is about the culture of Hong Kong and nothing to do with the government. I mean, obviously, Hong Kong was affected in 2002-03 with the SARS virus, and you write in your book that you were a very young child then, but you do remember aspects of it, empty restaurants and so on. It's been true all over the world, I suppose, that places have reflected their culture in their response. Can you tell us a bit more about that, and particularly in relation to what your city has learned from the SARS outbreak those years ago?
We all learned from the SARS outbreak in 2003. First is wearing surgical masks is a must in the pandemic. Second, never trust on China. The SARS outbreak is from Guangzhou in China. They just export the virus from China to Hong Kong, and the outbreak just result in a lot of medical workers pass away, and which is just a nightmare for Hong Konger in 2003. But soon later, in 2020, all we learn a lesson. As with the outbreak of pandemic and the outbreak of COVID-19, we must stand as one in solidarity. Apart from cultural of Hong Konger, it also about how we are more sensitive to the discourse and propaganda from Beijing. When the number of confirmed cases, the figure or information provided by Beijing is never true at all, it's lack of transparency. I think how Taiwan and Hong Kong are the two most remarkable models for world to take reference. Two places, no matter Hong Kong and Taiwan, might have different situation. Taiwan still being recognized as kind of a country, but Hong Kong is still a city. But I think the common ground of these two places is all we share the dissatisfaction to Beijing. And when Beijing delivered a message to WHO to say that the outbreak in Wuhan is not really serious or etc., no one in Taiwan and Hong Kong trusts on it. And that's why we try our best to strengthen the civil society development and to solve and to confront the outbreak of virus.
One of the other notable things has been that the leadership to the virus, the response to the virus, has been local. In places. It's not been presidents and prime ministers as much as Lord Mayors and governors and so on. Tell us about the response of your chief executive officer, Beijing appointed Carrie Lam, your nemesis as much as the other way around. How has she responded to this outbreak?
According to the survey conducted by Reuters, the dissatisfaction rate to the city's leader, Carrie Lam, increased from December to March, which people are pissed off by how Carrie Lam refused to shut down the border. Technically speaking, how Hong Kong and Taiwan are the places that really close to China in the region therefore. But why Taiwan can solve the outbreak of coronavirus early than Hong Kong is because Hong Kong government refused to shut down the border and still allow mainland traveler travel from China, including Wuhan, to Hong Kong on February, which just result in the outbreak of virus. So why medical worker in Hong Kong organized the labor strike on February is because how they realize and dissatisfied with the arrangement of Hong Kong government, how Hong Kong government just override public health issue by national pride, which is crystal clear.
Have you felt a larger sense of China bearing down on Hong Kong during this, and in particular with the use of technology? We know that it's use is widespread in China, tracking devices, surveillance and so on. How has that been used to your knowledge in Hong Kong?
Mass surveillance is the things that we face, and just like how Beijing recommended to impose the facial recognition surveillance system, not only in China, but even in Hong Kong. That's what we experienced and realized and opposed since last year. with the plan to a facial recognition system and those CCTV in Hong Kong, I think how Hong Kong already transferred it to be a police state since last summer is all we aware and experience. And that's also the reason how we try to keep on the fight and let those upper class leader in Beijing to realize that confront and overcome the virus is critical and important. But it doesn't mean that we need to sacrifice our privacy right and our privacy. I think the remarkable and the most significant model in Taiwan just imply that confront the COVID-19 doesn't mean that we need to sacrifice the principle of human rights.
You mentioned at the outset about the effect on your protest movement. Can we go into that in a bit more detail about how your organisation and others have adapted? What more specifically have you had to do, and what's working for you and what worries you?
As I mentioned, under the outbreak of COVID-19, we are difficult to mobilise people, talk to the street. But just like Hong Kong people are really creative, and we love to use different platform and channel to express our political belief. And lots of Hong Kongers just transformed the island in Animal Crossing, one of the most popular Nintendo Switch game, turned the island to be a protest site, to add some of the protest art in the video game, and to even organize virtual protests inside the game and engage with game player in Hong Kong. So I think even we can't mobilize people take to the street in the short run, we still can try our best to express our political belief in different ways. Before the outbreak of COVID-19, none of the Hong Kongers or even no one in the global community could imagine we can use some of the video game in Switch to organize protests, but Hong Kongers did it. At the same time, when the number of confirmed cases rapidly dropped to zero for more than 2 weeks, Hong Kongers are planning to have protests again on Sunday, and to urge Hong Kong government hold the accountability of the police brutality, especially since last summer, the number of arrested protesters are now more than 8,000 already, which is even more than the number of prisoners in Hong Kong right now.
It's hard to believe that it's around a year ago that more than a million people were turning up in protests in Hong Kong. How are you reflecting on that now, when you're mostly confined to your houses and, of course, under all these restrictions? Is it terribly frustrating?
Since last summer, we are aware how Hong Kong transformed from a global financial center to a police state. No matter being fired by rubber bullets, tear gas, and even journalists, the eye turned blind because of being fired by bullets, and government and police never apologized for it. And protester, a young lady being gang raped inside police station just because of they participated in the protest, and none of the police were investigated or face any kind of penalty, which is really insane of how they turn such the district, the residential area in Hong Kong to be a war zone by uncountable canister of tear gas, rubber bullets, and even use live round to fire to high school students. But I think the fundamental request for Hong Kong people is crystal clear and easy to understand. If international city just like Sydney, people in Sydney can elect the mayor, so why can't Hong Kong? The only reason behind is how Beijing eroded their promise and just do not respect on international standard of democracy and human rights. We just hope to get a vote to elect our government.
In November last year, you were banned from running in the local elections because it was said to be incompatible, your platform, with the basic law. Tell us more about those so-called incompatibilities.
With the political censorship and the red line generated by Beijing, youngsters who advocate on civil disobedience, referendum, or etc., were barred to run for office. Even lawmakers that were democratically elected were forcefully unseated by Beijing without any legitimate reason. On the upcoming election on September, no surprise at all, Beijing might plan to disqualify or unseat lawmakers again. But just like last November, in the local election, 85% of the seats won by Democratic camp, which is the landslide victory and the miracle in Hong Kong that we never imagined in the past. So when we take the majority in the district council and transformed the district council as the voice to represent Hong Kong, we also hope to enjoy another landslide victory in the upcoming legislative council election, which could be understood as the parliament or the Congress of Hong Kong. And we hope to, through the election, take the majority in the legislative council and let legislative council to be the place that could express the value of democracy instead of the place to gather those red capitals, background elites, or Beijing loyalists.
How do you go about that, Joshua? When I, you know, look back on your history as an activist since you were 14 years old, and a history that's spiked with some very significant victories, they came about from what seemed like very intuitive, but of course was very well planned, very traditional forms of protest. Very simple. You were out on the street corners every day, talking to people with a little megaphone, leafleting, supporting candidates in their efforts to get elected to various government posts and so on. How do you translate that now in May of 2020 to September elections with the restrictions and the pressure that's coming to bear from China?
Under the hardline suppression of President Xi, one country, two system is strongly eroded. High degree autonomy almost fades out. And the legal system in Hong Kong is just manipulated by Beijing. We always recognize Hong Kong legal system as kind of sugar-coated rule of law. And that's the era of Emperor Xi Jinping, especially when the constitution amended. How many years? 5, 10, 15, or 20 will Xi Jinping still be the leader of China? That's the question that no one could provide an answer. But world leaders are worried about it. That's also the reason we encourage people to stand with Hong Kong.
You write interestingly about Hong Kong patriotism. And one of the things you say is that the Chinese Communist Party have achieved something that British colonialism was never able to achieve, and that is a particular Hong Kong patriotism. Why is that?
We hope to enhance people's sense of belonging to Hong Kong. The generation of baby boomers in Hong Kong might always assume Hong Kong is kind of borrowed the place, borrowed the time, and they didn't belong to these places. But as the one who born in Hong Kong, who live in Hong Kong, and who love Hong Kong, how I really hope people recognize that even we are under the hardline rule of China and Beijing, we are still proud to be Hong Konger.
You describe Hong Kong as a foster child. Explain that to our audience.
Hong Kong is under British rule before 1997, and the sovereignty is transferred to China without any authorization of Hong Kongers. Hong Kongers didn't have a say on the Hong Kong sovereignty and constitutional arrangement. That's what people experienced in the last century. But when people hope to be the master of their own house, I think how Hong Kong, even being recognized as kind of a region in under the rule of Beijing for around 23 years, we are still proud and hope to continue to enhance people to recognize that Hong Kong is not only a global financial center under the hardline rule of Beijing, that our freedom are being tightened by China. Hong Kong is also a protest city with lots of people are not only recognize themselves as economic animal. Here is the place that people proud to be Hong Konger and hope to fight for freedom and democracy.
And that's a new thing, isn't it? I mean, it hasn't always been like that in Hong Kong. And again, you describe that well in the book.
Yeah, that's the transformation of Hong Kong. Before last summer, no one could imagine more than 2 million people could take to the street because Hong Kong is only a 7 million population small city. But we did it. Almost one-fourth of the population stand up against the hardline crackdown of Beijing and just let people around the world to know that kowtow to China or be the panda hugger, that's not the only way out. Even Hong Kong now is under the territories of Beijing. We are under the hardline rule, but we can not kowtow to China, and our voice would not be silenced by Beijing, and we can still continue to fight for the value that we all believe in. And under the retreat of democracy, uprise of populism, people might doubt that is democracy still important or is still accountable at all. But at least in Hong Kong, people are still fighting for freedom, and we hope to let the world to know that democracy is still the value that we cherish.
What are your lessons for activists elsewhere? I mean, there are protests going on or attempts at protest all over the world. I read a very interesting book recently by the Turkish journalist Ece Temelkuran on how to lose a country. What are your lessons for people seeking to organise protests in other places?
Different country might have different cultural background and historical path, which might be a bit difficult to directly copy what experienced by Hong Kong for people in different country. But I think the most unique, the most important element of Hong Kong protest is it emphasized the importance of how we never kowtow to China and how we stand in the forefront to confront the largest authoritarian regime in the world. And secondly, it's also about youth activism and cross-generation cooperation. In the previous day, we always assumed that only youngsters were engaged in street activism. I think that's true a few years ago. But now in Hong Kong, more than 8,000 people were arrested. The youngest one at the age of 11 is still a primary school kid. The oldest one at the age of 84. So right now, no matter baby boomers or Gen X or millennial, all we stand as one with solidarity. And even we are facing the largest authoritarian regime, China already transformed itself to be the second largest superpower in the world. People might be threatened and try to make friends with China. Of course, people could have respect to people live in China. But I think that now is the time to stand up and let Beijing to realize that no matter since the protests of last summer or the outbreak of COVID-19, China, if they need to be recognized and being respected in the world, they must recognize and respect liberal value and international order.
You were so young, Joshua, when you began your life as a public activist at the age of 14, and we're seeing that leadership in the world from really young people, Greta Thunberg, Malala, this really has been overtaken, the world of activism, by your generation really successfully in terms of at least getting a message heard. What's your sense of how that makes more grown-up people, older people, actually they're not really more grown-up, are they, but they're older, feel about these issues? When I look at video footage, for example, of you at the age of 17 being dragged away by the police, and they're very upsetting images, this sense that somebody so young had to take up this challenge yourself, because in that moment nobody else was going to do it. What's your feeling about that, about being so young and needing to do this?
Compared to high school student being fired by a life round, what I experienced 6 years ago during the umbrella movement is just a small piece of cake. And there's no reason for us to regret and step backward. Now we are under the totalitarian crackdown from Beijing. Sometimes we might feel downheart or depressed, but I just remember how my colleagues and friends share their experience and ready to pay the price. We must continue our fight in such uphill battle. That's also what I experienced.
Tell us about your experience in prison, where you spend a couple of months, several years after you were originally arrested for climbing the gates during the umbrella movement. What was it like for you to be in prison?
When I was in prison, I didn't being beaten up by the prison guards, but now more than 100 of activists being locked up in prison. Some of them were tortured by the prison staff that belongs to the pro-Beijing camp. So that's really the difficult time. Prison guard just jumped and forcibly smashed their backs with elbows and to torture political prisoners. And some of the remand political prisoners told me that they were abused by the prison guard roughly 3 to 5 times every week. And with such discriminatedly target and torture to political prisoners, now it's really a difficult time for us.
You met a really wide range of people while you were in prison. They weren't all political prisoners. In fact, most of them weren't. They were mostly young men in for drug offences and that sort of thing, some very violent crimes. But what did it teach you about human beings, about class, about inequality, about opportunity? Mm. What did you learn from that experience that has shaped the way you work now?
Yeah. With how being jailed for 3 times and previous experience engaged in social movement, I just realized how the uneven income distribution, how the grassroots being suppressed is most from red capital pro-Beijing tycoons and businessmen, and how they just form the elite circles with those government officials continue erodes on people freedom and also the livelihood of the young generation are more difficult in the recent days. That also really disappointed.
How have you changed though? And not just since then, but perhaps in the last 10 years since you first began, you've grown up. You've grown up as under the public eye. You've grown up as, a boy that took on communist China, a nation state that terrifies most other nation states. How have you changed?
In the previous day, I might feel a bit tired or depressed, but I think since last summer, the movement changed me a lot and encouraged me to realize that greater power comes with greater responsibility, and I hope to let the voice of Hong Kong is being heard.
The current deal between Hong Kong and the Communist Party in China, it runs out in 2047. You'll be 50 exactly when that happens, and it'll probably come about faster than you think. You're very grim in your assessment of where that's going to land, in the book at least you are. What are your reasons for feeling so pessimistic about where this will end up, and where indeed do you think Hong Kong will be by that time?
I think in the new generation, as a youngster born a year before the transfer of sovereignty, which is a bit difficult for us to imagine what happened since last summer, and also hard for us to hold the crystal ball and to predict a different scenario in 2047. But what we hope is people could be the master of our own house, and we deserve the right one day could determine our destiny. And Hong Kong should be the place that allow people to choose their way of living instead of being manipulated by Beijing.
Do you think it will be?
Hope for the best, prepare for the worst, and never surrender to Beijing.
How do you prepare for the worst?
How we day by day engage in the movement and let the world to know that how Hong Kongers never kowtow to China since last summer. The protest movement is already the strongest evidence to prove that we are preparing for the worst, but also keeping hope in the best scenario.
You're very interesting in terms of your very first political battle over the education bill proposal. The Communist Party wanted to introduce the national education. You were 14, as I said, and you won. It was a very, very big victory, and it occurred to me that most people who protest, or certainly many, they can have a life of protest and never have a single victory. You had a massive one at the outset. Things have become more complicated since then as the challenges have become more complicated. But how does that shape you? Do you think that, do you have an expectation that, you will win, that this must be won? And what does it look like to win?
Hong Kongers have nothing to lose, and that's the reason we continue our fight. And also, we recognize the importance to let the world to know that how we never step backward. Since 2012, engaged in the anti-national education movement to confront the patriotic authoritarian ideology to be delivered in school curriculum, I already realized that that's a long-term battle. Perhaps it may be recognized as kind of infinity war, but I never believe now is the end game of Hong Kong, and we still have hope on people, even though I have no hope towards the government.
Is it inevitable that it will turn into a sort of battle for independence?
We are fighting for democracy and autonomy, and that's the majority consensus of Hong Kong.
Tell me, what then does a freedom look like in the interim? Is it about incremental gains, or you continue to stay on those big picture protest desires, needs?
I think different people in Hong Kong have different idea in mind about the future outcome, different possibilities. But at least what I wish and hope is we could continue the fights, even now might be the hard time for us.
And so how do you bring those conflicting groups together? Because there are, it's something you've been quite successful with, certainly in the protests at certain times last year. But you've got moderate groups, of course, that have sought peaceful protest. You've had more radical groups. There's been violence. How do you continue to remain as some form of loose coalition?
With the police brutality. It just encouraged our solidarity.
You put in the book that you've got a lovely, a delightful quote from J.K. Rowling that what's coming will come and we'll meet it when it does. I suppose I wonder what you think will be the outcome of the elections in September. If we can get back to the shorter term and where you'll think you'll be heading from there.
Which is hard for us to predict those outcomes, but all we can do is to maximize the possibility for us to put pressure on Beijing, yeah.
You know, everybody in Australia, of course, is watching this very closely, Joshua, and particularly, of course, last year during the mass protests. And I mean, one of the problems, of course, with coronavirus is that so many other hugely important issues fall away. And as space becomes available, I suppose, for them to come back, it's going to be a crowded field, isn't it? And I mean, how are you going in your conversations internationally? You went to Washington last year. You had some success there in an act of a congressional act. Explain that to us, but also talk about where those conversations are going with other countries and how much they're impacted at the moment.
We hope to enhance Global Magnitsky Act or Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act being passed and imposed to sanction government official in Hong Kong or riot police abuse of power and the crackdown on protests. 4 years ago, since I tried my best to engage in international advocacy and lobbying, I never imagined Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act could pass in the US Congress. But I think after it could successfully pass since last November in US Congress, I think it just sent a clear signal to Beijing. Support Hong Kong is not a matter of left or right. It's the matter of right or wrong. And we try to seek for bipartisan support around the world and let them know that if we believe in freedom, democracy, and those liberal values, support Hong Kong, how we stand in the forefront is the most critical issue.
And finally, Joshua, what's your hope for your own future? You're quite unemployable in your own city by your own account. What do you hope for your own future?
If we can't see the future of Hong Kong, how we can see the future of new generation? So if we fight for a better future for our hometown, we wish every youngster or even young millennials younger than me can enjoy a brighter future in Hong Kong.
Well, I certainly hope that you can, and it's been fascinating to talk to you, and thank you so much for your time, Joshua Wong, and all the very best and take care.
Thank you.
Joshua Wong, in conversation with Sally Warhaft for The Fifth Estate. If you enjoyed this conversation, visit wheelercentre.com for more than 100 episodes from the series. And if you're feeling generous, please consider a donation. In a fortnight, Human Rights Watch Deputy Program Director Tom Porteous joins us from Paris. Until then, thanks for joining us and take care.